This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Thanks so much for coming. So I'm trying an experiment today, which is that there's two of us up here giving the Dharma talk. I'm Dan Zygmunt. I'm one of the guiding teachers here, and this is Will Kabat-Zinn, who is a Dharma teacher, has taught often at Spirit Rock, trained in both the Theravada and Vipassana tradition and the Chinese Chan tradition, and we became friends, and he agreed to come visit, and I thought it might be fun to give a talk together. I think about the arc of our practice as it came to us here at this temple. This temple was founded by Kobenchino Odagawa Roshi, who brought it from Japan. But of course, before that practice could get to Japan, it had to start in India, develop the meditation techniques that eventually spread to Burma and Sri Lanka and Thailand, and then from that oldest form of Buddhism, go to China, where it encountered Taoism and Chinese Zen developed, and then from China to Japan, when the great teacher Ehe Dogen ventured from Japan to China, and then carried that practice back with him. So Will, he represents those first two steps before it could even get to Japan and then eventually to us. So I thought it might be fun for us to talk a little together. We usually start by introducing ourselves, which was a lot easier when hardly anyone was coming. But it's wonderful to see so many people now and to see the Zendo so full. But what we usually do is just say our names. So Dan, I'll pass to the next person.
I'm Will.
Marie.
Todd.
Ben.
Masui.
Woman.
Sarah.
Lydia.
Julie.
Esther.
In the back.
Nico.
Laura.
Daria.
Yvonne.
Jim.
Jacob.
Samara.
Amelia.
Sabah.
Dan.
Ryu.
Owen.
Matthew.
Florian.
Jiro.
Mark.
Hugh.
Amanda.
Welcome. So.
What about the other one?
Oh, I find it a little hard to do all the Zoom folks, but welcome also to everybody who's joining us online. So, Will, you mentioned that it had been a long time since you were in a Japanese-style Zen temple. I don't know, maybe you just want to say, what is it like being here as one of our ancestors?
I love that. I don't know exactly what the line is, but where you all chant is, we're the ancestors of the future.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good aspiration. It's lovely to be here. And yeah, it's so heartening to be in person together and to be practicing and to be a part of the tradition, like this powerful, beautiful tradition. It's one of the things, and I'm not trained in Japanese Zen, but just that I appreciate so much the forms and the emptiness, but the holding of the form is so powerful. So that's the first thing that I kind of sense being here.
These days I do a lot of meditation teaching with beginners. That's sort of been my path for the last few years, that I'm often teaching in places where, you know, people have never meditated before, or maybe they've meditated a little, but it's their first kind of formal practice. We did an all-day meditation yesterday, and there were some people, one back there, who had never meditated before, and today we had a few newcomers as well. And people often ask me, sort of, you know, because you almost can't help these days but know a little bit about meditation, you know, what is the difference between Zen and Vipassana? Maybe people have had friends who go and do Vipassana retreats and have heard about these other things. I always feel like I don't have anything very interesting to say in answer to that question. Because at some level, you know, in some even maybe superficial ways, they're quite different. I mean, you know, we wear, our teachers wear these robes and you know, look like we're from a Kurosawa movie. And you get to teach like in your street clothes.
Looks like a regular schmo.
So, you know, there are certainly some differences and these sort of almost aesthetic differences, you know, that we focus so much on the form. But I often think, you know, in terms of the actual practice you do, especially when you're just getting started, that they're very similar. I don't know. I wonder if you have thoughts on differences, similarities, any of that.
Oh, has this come up for you all too? Does this, are you exposed to many different, one of the unique things about being here at this time where there's so many streams of practice and so many different styles, it can be kind of like sometimes confusing, sometimes exciting. And so I'll say just a few things. I always think about your, you know, the kind of the lineage that we're sitting in the midst of, and I, again, just know of it because just from being around and Suzuki Roshi and I always think of something from his, the biography of him, The Crooked Cucumber, where he said, there was a line that stayed with me, I read it 20 years ago or whatever, but he said, I teach the Hinayana practice with the Mahayana mind. And I love that. And so I don't know what he meant.
I was going to ask for you to explain.
We'll have to wait for Dan to explain that. But there's, I think, one of the sort of like each of these, I feel like if you go deep enough into each of these streams, there's a way where, you know, so we, Dan and I met, became friends. There's a way in which like everything talks to itself or each other. But sometimes the forms can seem very different, and they are different. Right? But one thing I love about that line is that I think in the Theravada, sometimes there's some technique in the beginning, like a lot of just teachings, the foundations of mindfulness and stuff. But it's all aware breathing in, aware breathing out, aware with feelings and sensations, aware with pleasant and unpleasant, aware with mind and all the different states of mind. Right? This is the practice of the foundations of mindfulness text that goes back to the Buddha, really. You know, mindful with so all the different states of mind, mindful with the sense doors, basically aware with the flow of experience. Right? And so that gives you a little bit of structure, whereas sometimes I think traditionally in Zen, right, I don't think Suzuki Roshi did it this way, but they just say, like, you sit, they don't tell you anything. I admire that. But I think sometimes that combination of the kind of, you know, having some anchors in how to just the basics of practice, and then the beauty of the emptiness, which hopefully start to sense, you know, I see that as like these twin elements. So, is that vague? Is that too vague?
Yeah, it's true that in Zen, although we have a lot of form to things like the service, and, you know, wearing these robes and chanting and bowing and these certain things you're supposed to do. And we're quite informal here. If you went to a more formal Zen temple, even the San Francisco Zen Center, or Tassajara, the monastery down near Carmel, or especially in Japan, you know, there's much more of this form. And yet, you know, you're right that the meditation, though, has very little structure. The core practice of Soto Zen is really what we call shikantaza, which translates as just sitting. And people sometimes have a hard time believing that that's really the practice, like you just sit. And I must admit, there have been times, I mean, actually still, where I feel almost some jealousy for these other traditions that just have more scaffolding, that have more structure. You know, maybe the most extreme is the Tibetan tradition, which just has all kinds of different practices and techniques. And sort of stages that you can get to as you try these different things. Whereas in Zen, you know, you can be practicing 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, and the instructions don't change. You just are supposed to sit. But at the same time, you know, just because something is simple doesn't mean that it's easy. And so even though it's very easy to explain our practice, you know, when I do meditation instruction for anyone who's new, and I do it in like 15 minutes. I mean, it's not complicated to explain. But there's real depth to it. So a friend of mine who has done a few different meditation practices, the analogy he used is it's like playing a video game, and in Zen you don't get any cheat codes. You just have to play through, you know, with no help. Whereas some of these other traditions, they give you these like little codes you can use to kind of help yourself along. That just made me more jealous.
I love that. You know, what this, my Chan teacher, who was in actually, they, you know, in the same lineage that they call Soto in Japan, you know, and I was, you know, just sad with him. So I was not a formal disciple or anything. It's important to say, just a student. But he talked about silent illumination, right? And that goes back to the, you know, cultivating the empty field, right? This like old text from that lineage. It's very simple. But the silence, and again, once we get a little depth in like some of the different nuances, like we can understand where it's similar. So in Theravada Buddhism, they talk about samatha and vipassana, you know, concentration and insight. Right? And then in Chan, talk about silent illumination. The silence is the stillness of presence, and the illumination is the illumination of basic awareness. So when you have that sense of the simplicity of silent, and they're not two really, right? But the silence of being and the luminosity of awareness, then practice can be pretty simple, right? And I think that's a beautiful thing. I actually love that. It's like we have so many, I so appreciate that being here in this lineage, right? There, we have so much to do these days, right? It's like so much, oh, go, everything's to do, to get somewhere, to self-improve, to be on your way somewhere, even spiritual stuff is like that. And I love that simplicity in this stream, just sit, Yeah, and that's a very advanced practice. You know that, right? It's not, yeah, it's so good you said it. And I love that. And that's what's partly so beautiful to me about being here with you all. We're just sitting together in that so powerfully expressing ourselves, right? Just, yeah.
And it is so powerful to do it in a group. I think at some level I always knew that, but it's sort of a cliche that you don't appreciate things until they're gone. But when we couldn't sit in a group, I really remembered how special it was to sit with other people, which is sort of strange in a way, because you might think that meditation is like the ultimate solitary activity. I mean, you're quiet, you're not talking, you're not really doing anything together. And yet the truth is, in the Buddhist tradition, it's almost always been done in groups. I mean, if you think about it before, you know, the advent of sort of popular books on meditation, which are, you know, less than 100 years old, the only way you could learn to meditate is to go find a teacher who would teach you along with a bunch of other students. So you couldn't really learn to meditate and practice on your own. You had to go join a group of people who were learning together. And really, from the time of the Buddha, you know, Buddha had his awakening experience alone, but then almost immediately started teaching groups, you know, sometimes hundreds of students at the same time. And we've been basically practicing in groups ever since for 2,500 years. And so the sort of recent trend of people learning to meditate on their own and just meditating at home by themselves, you know, at first with books and now with, you know, apps and things like that. I mean, that's really the anomaly. That's, you know, sort of historically speaking, that's kind of weird. Meditation has always been something we do together. And certainly my experience of not being able to meditate in a group for, you know, at least a year that we, and Jokoji was really pretty much closed. It's really special to meditate with other people. It really feels different.
Oh, yeah. I was, when you're saying that, I was thinking of like all the culture is so powerful, right? And we're all, what's become normal. I was thinking about some relatives of mine and their phone. And me too, to a lesser degree. I'll just be honest, right? But some, it's like just very taken over by the, you know, by what's become normal in terms of how much to be, you know, plugged into things in various ways. It's just become, when it becomes normal, that we just do that and don't think about it. And I think that's when you talk about practicing in a group, and part of what's so powerful for me about coming, driving down here and being in the space and seeing like the care, we're standing here, and the care with which you do the service, and it's like that's also contagious, I feel, right? And it's so affecting to be here, and I think that's where, when we care about wakefulness, you know, we care about presence, we care about freedom, inner freedom. It's, I just feel that we need that. And so I think that's such a wonderful topic for us. And it's like, oh, and that's really helpful with the group because the norms are different. And it'd be really hard to invent something like this that you are doing here, right? To start it from scratch, because people wouldn't follow it. But since you have something, what a beautiful thing to enter with, you know, to join.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, we you know, we have some internet up here. That's why we're able to do these Zoom connections with people all over, which is really wonderful, and allowed us to continue this weekly practice, which we did maybe not entirely uninterrupted, but almost entirely uninterrupted through the pandemic. We kept doing a Sunday service, and we did some sesshins and things. Even we did them all online. And it's a little shaky up here. We do lose it sometimes. And I was just talking to one of the residents, and we're actually about to upgrade it because we now can get some satellite internet that we couldn't get before. And of course, that would have been even more helpful like 2 years ago, but now we finally can get it. But I have to admit, I have like somewhat mixed feelings about it. You know, when I first started coming up here, I was ordained here in 98. You know, we just had this one landline, and that was all we had. So if I was staying up here for a week, I married, and back then my kids were quite small. You know, like once a day I would go use the landline and call my wife and just make sure everything was okay. And that was it. Now we have like Wi-Fi, and, you know, you can actually be online while you're up here. You can do Zoom meetings. You can do all kinds of things. And it's nice in a way, but it also, there is something really powerful about completely disconnecting. And I was thinking about what you just said about you couldn't invent something like this. It's also, for most of us, really hard to disconnect unless it's sort of forced on us, like because you're out of range. And so that used to be something that was really special here, is that you were just out of range. It didn't matter if you wanted to disconnect or not, you disconnected. Now we have to make that, you know, a conscious effort.
Well, it just made me think of the importance of contrast in having a sense of anything. Right? It's very hard to have a sense of what we're immersed in unless there's a contrast, right? Mm-hmm. Something other. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the beautiful qualities of practice, right? If you don't have a sense of zero, you don't know what like four is, or eight, mm-hmm. or 27. Mm-hmm. But so it's just like a beautiful thing to have a sense of like, whether it's zero or not, who knows what that even means. But just to have a sense of stillness, I think that's one of the, to me, what I notice when people have a taste of practice or go on retreat, or and they get a taste of the mind when it's not just completely taken over by proliferation all the time. That can be a completely transformative thing for somebody. I said, that's even directionally possible. And so I think it's not trivial that when we're here together and we drop in even a little bit, because then when you go back, it's different. And I think hopefully you're aware of that. And so you're in relationship then to whatever has become normal, whether it's internally normal or externally normal. I think that's very important.
Last summer, I went and I spent a week at Tassajara, the Zen monastery that I mentioned, in part because, you know, since we don't do such a formal practice here, I wanted to get some pointers on, you know, how you're supposed to wear these robes and how to do the bows and things, because I, you know, I don't do it very much. You know, the monks who live there, I mean, they live in these, they wear these robes every day, so they're very polished. And there was one monk in particular I was interested in talking to, I remember. And so I went there, you know, I, as I mentioned, I live what we call in Buddhism a householder life. So I have a house and family and I have a job. But I, you know, I took a week off and I went to Tassajara. And it turned out that one of the monks that I wanted to see was also on vacation. But for his vacation, you know, he left the monastery. And what you said about contrast made me think that you know, he wanted contrast too, but the contrast he wanted was, you know, he wanted to go to San Francisco. You know, that contrast, I think, whether you're living at a monastery or you're living in a city, it helps you appreciate that life, and also, you know, to notice it. You know, there's this old expression that you know, fish don't know that they're wet. And you know, even living in a temple can become just a routine where you stop sort of noticing what you're doing every day. And certainly, I think a lot of us find that in our daily life, you know, in our householder life. And getting that contrast, you know, helps us in the same way that sometimes, you know, traveling and visiting another place makes you appreciate where you live. Coming here, you know, helps us notice the little things that are different about our life. I think it can be really helpful.
Yeah.
Maybe we could open up to some questions, either in the room or of course on the Zoom as well. If anyone had anything they wanted to ask or to talk about. Yeah, please.
I was thinking about what you were asking about at the beginning. Last week, a newcomer asked a question about what to do with the thinking while trying to sit, which certainly resonated with me and I think a lot of people. And so I have meditated in the past and things like breath, and counting breath, which seemed busy to me, so I would do one. Suzuki Roshi wrote a lot about posture, and I never stopped breathing, but I was always losing my posture. So I'm what to think about. So I think I should be thinking something more around my posture, because this seems to be constantly lost.
I'll repeat the question, because probably people on Zoom can't hear that you're... I don't know if I'll fully do it justice, but your question was about sort of... that a question had come up in the past, maybe last week, about sort of what to do with the thinking that comes up while we sit. And there are these different techniques, like focusing on your breathing. But also, if you read the sort of the modern Zen texts in our tradition, they talk a lot about posture. So maybe we should be focused on correct posture. So I also focus a lot on posture when I teach. And in fact, when I do retreats, I correct postures. So I walk around the Zendo and help people try to find that upright posture. I do that because, you know, for a few reasons. I mean, one, I always liked it when I was a student first learning Zen. I also think there's something about, again, that like the physicality of sitting that we think about. We sometimes think about meditation as like a mental pursuit, but that it is also a physical thing. It's something that you do with your body. And finding that upright posture, I think, helps keep us in our body while we're sitting. There are practical things like, you know, if you're sort of all slumped forward like this, it's easier to fall asleep. That little bit of effort that it takes to stay upright, I think it's quite difficult to stay upright and fall asleep at the same time. Similarly, you know, people, you know, drop their head or even like start to stare out into space. It's much easier to kind of get into a daydreamy sort of state that way. So there are these practical things. But in some ways, to me, these are all just sort of techniques that have evolved to try to keep us present, to keep us in this moment. So, and I always, you know, I always go back to the Buddha's teachings that you shouldn't take anything on faith, you should just try things out, and that you should try it out. And, you know, for some people, focusing on the breath is really, really powerful. And because the breath is this sort of natural metronome, it helps them stay present. For some people, the posture is very, very helpful. You know, some people can't sit upright and might do their meditation standing or laying down, sitting in a chair. So it isn't, I think, something that's necessary, but I find it I find it very helpful. But you're right, we talked about sort of some of the differences in the Zen tradition, some of the other traditions, and this focus on posture is one of the things that seems to be a bit of a quirk of Zen. And maybe, I mean, since the basic meditation practice is so simple, it's just, we don't have anything else to talk about. So we talk about the posture. But I don't know, how do you think about posture with sitting?
I love that idea. Just so that, you know, that's one of the things I actually appreciate about in this tradition is the emphasis on posture. I think it's I think it's very powerful as a kind of structure for sort of, we're talking about the formlessness of awareness itself or wakefulness itself, right? If you have very little to do, again, the posture, if you sense the body continuously, that gives you some real stability, right? And so I think one of the places people can get a little tripped up is if they think it's about getting back to the right posture, then you're kind of tinkering all the time. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you are maintaining like the emphasis on staying continuously aware, you can still straighten your posture, but it's really just like, that's part of the continuity of presence. Right? So as opposed to like, oh, I lost it, I got it, I lost it, I got it. Because you could tinker forever probably. I could tinker forever. So I've gotten into tinkering at times, and it's like never ending. But I think that's a beautiful thing. If you have that as a kind of like, that's your anchor, so to speak, is the body, and I think it is very powerful to have the posture be maybe the reference, right? And it could be the breathing, but I think that's we use that term anchor as like a anchor for the awareness, and as that gets stable with the body, then you start to get a sense of the stability and presence of wake of awareness. Right? You mentioned the thinking, like when you like about, oh, how do you deal with the thinking? And there's different ways, lots of different methods or something, but I think one thing is if you have that continuous emphasis with the body, then you can just let the thinking happen in the background. You can let the thoughts come and go. It's the being, you know, or you can come back to the body if you're really caught up, like, oh, you can come back to the body. I think that's just a way, right? And then, but as you sense the body, let thoughts, when they stop bothering you, they're just part of experience, thinking just like anything else. So I love that emphasis on the posture. I actually think in the traditions, including the ones I practiced in, where it's not so emphasized, I think you lose kind of a yogic element in the practice. There's a kind of almost like that you said embodied. I think that's a very powerful part of it. I have all kinds of weird thoughts about that, but I won't share them now.
Looks like we have a question on the Zoom. A hand has been up. I can't read whose name it is.
Judy.
It's me, Judy. Dan. Judy.
Okay.
Hi.
Oh, hi, Judy.
Hi. So I was having a discussion with a friend, and he wondered about belief in Zen. Can you talk about belief in Soto Zen?
Yeah. So, I don't think about belief a lot. I mentioned, I think in the last question, this approach of, you know, that we shouldn't take things on faith. We should try things out, and pay attention to the results. And to me, that's the core thing is that we're always paying attention to the world as it is. And I think of meditation as part of what makes that possible and trains us to do that. And so, you know, I think about meditation and the practice of Zen a little bit like a microscope or a telescope, which can affect your beliefs because it lets you see things that you wouldn't otherwise see. And I suppose there's some level of belief that you're trusting that what you're seeing is real. But the thing that's really informing your belief is what you see. Another way I sometimes think about it, you know, is meditating each morning. It's a little bit like cleaning my glasses. You know, it's just something that lets me see a little more clearly. So in that way, as I said, it affects my beliefs, but it affects them by making it easier for me to see the world as it is. And then it's really the world that's affecting my beliefs. It's paying attention to what's happening and to cause and effect and all that. I don't know, what do you think, Will?
I think that's I think it's a wonderful question, and I think it's a beautiful response about the microscope or the and just what I guess the part I think about in relation to that is, like, I guess it takes some belief or something to, like, look through the microscope. Like, you have to have some faith. Like, we use the term, you know, in the early tradition, they talk a lot about faith, right? And faith is different than belief the way it's used in early Buddhism, at least. I don't know about Zen, right? So faith is this, I think of it as, like, well, the root of it in Pali is, like, has to do with, like, resting your heart on something. Mm. So there's a kind of quality of resting the heart. I think of the faith as, like, say, like, a, hey, there's, like, a, you know, somebody here says, like, there's a water fountain, like, in the building up there. I haven't been here before. I say, like, is this person trustworthy? You know, so I think of that as, like, the looking through, or, hey, I got this tip for cleaning your glasses. I see they're pretty smudged. And then you do it a few times and you see, oh, hey, they are a little cleaner. You know, I see a little better. So I do think there's an element, there is an element of trust, I guess, that's needed up front, enough to, like, sit and do something very weird seeming to people. Not you all who have been in it starts to seem normal, but doesn't look normal, like, for, like, conventional. So I feel like that's an element that does require some trust. And then that whole aspect of seeing more clearly, I think, that's such a great lens. And then the faith comes from experience. That's the way I've seen it in so many practitioners. The faith comes from, like, oh, even seeing a little more clearly, it's not the way it was before. And that when that starts to lead to actual change in how we experience things, then the faith deepens. And so that's a beautiful relationship between kind of clear seeing and the faith or confidence. I like the word confidence too. It's like confident in that. Mm. Yeah.
Ivan.
Thank you for being here and for coming to visit. It's funny, I found Buddhism because I was looking for meditation, and I was looking for places to meditate in a group and learn about it. So I went to Spirit Rock, you know, I went to San Francisco Zen Center, inside meditation. I tried everything, right? I was just looking for the right place. And at the end, I chose San Francisco Zen Center because it was more available, right? I live in San Francisco and we had, like, all this big offering of, like, the program was extensive. I could just come at any time. There was meditation. There was just very available, right? And I fell in love with the form and the sounds and the smells and the bells and just, you know. But it's funny how, I have friends in Spirit Rock too. But I find is that in these, you know, these t-shirts, I think that when I look at the similarities instead of the differences, I see a lot of similarities, right? No matter how informal or formal the teachers are, there's always this sense of humor and kindness and thoughtfulness when they speak and compassion. And that's kind of what attracted me to Buddhism. So my question to maybe Dan or both of you is, what do you think Suzuki Roshi meant by that phrase in the Pali?
Well, the Hinayana.
Could you repeat that?
So the question was that, you know, like many people, Ivan has practiced at different places. He practiced at Spirit Rock and San Francisco Zen Center and Insight Meditation Center, and in the end, he practices mostly at the San Francisco Zen Center as much for convenience as anything else. It's just he lives near the San Francisco Zen Center. It's a perfectly good reason to practice somewhere. And he wanted to know about the quote that that Will offered from Suzuki Roshi about, can you say the quote again? I want to make sure I get it right.
I'm not sure I have it right because it's from 20 years ago memory, but I think he said, I teach the Hinayana practice with a Mahayana mind. That's my memory. That's the way it lodged in here.
So the way I sometimes think about sort of this whole practice, like I mentioned, you know, Buddhism developed in India. It spread first to the countries nearest to India, like Burma and Sri Lanka, and then to Thailand, which is sometimes called sort of the southern branch, because that's mostly a southern path. And then it traveled north to China, and from China to Korea, Vietnam, Japan. You know, like a lot of religions and a lot of philosophies and a lot of movements, as it developed, it sort of accumulated stuff. So, you know, the Pali canon, which is the oldest scriptures of Buddhism, you know, I mean, I have them in translation, and like, you know, they're like that much of a bookshelf. I mean, they're not that much. Few thousand pages, bigger than the Bible, maybe as much as 10,000 pages. The Bible's more like 1,000. But still, like it's... And then, you know, as the Mahayana tradition developed in India and China and so forth, and eventually Tibet, I mean, it got... Now you're talking like a whole bookshelf. I mean, I think the Mahayana canon is another 10 times bigger. It's like 80,000, 90,000 pages. All these other things, you know, got added. And I sometimes think what happened in, and I should say, a lot of really interesting stuff. I mean, if you study these later sutras and study the Tibetan scriptures and things like that, I mean, people spend their whole lives studying, you know, one of these. A lot of really interesting stuff. But I think in some ways, Zen was a bit of a reaction against all that and sort of wanting to like get simple again. So it sort of got more and more complicated. And then some, you know, monks and nuns and folks thought it like, okay, now we want to like get simple again. And so, you know, if you read Suzuki Roshi's book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, or if you practiced with him or with Koben, who started this temple, I mean, he hardly ever talks about any of those sutras. The main sutra that we chant, which we chanted this morning, the Heart Sutra, I think it's no coincidence. It's like, it's the shortest one. It's, you know, it's one page. and that, I mean, for a lot of people who study Zen, even for a long time, that's the only sutra they ever read. And it's this one page sutra. And so, you know, I think there was this sense of wanting to get back to a very simple style of practice. So I imagine that's what he meant by the Hinayana practice, like wanting to not get caught up in all these very complicated things that are described in these other sutras and in the Chinese canon and the Tibetan canon and so forth. So I'm guessing that maybe is what he meant by the Hinayana practice. So then the question is, what did he mean by the Mahayana mind? And, you know, one of the ideas that came out of these later traditions was this real focus on the bodhisattva, on wanting to care for others. This word bodhisattva exists in the earliest sutras. But mostly what it means in these early sutras is like the Buddha before he becomes Buddha. So it's someone who's going to be a Buddha, but they're not quite a Buddha yet. And in this later tradition, it still has that meaning, but with this little bit of a twist that it's someone who sort of could be a Buddha, who could realize perfect awakening, but they're sort of deliberately waiting because they want to focus on helping other people first. They want to help everyone else become awakened first. And so I think that, I mean, that idea was sort of, was latent in those early sutras. Like I said, the word is there. But that became this real emphasis, that the ideal isn't even really to become a Buddha. The ideal is to become a bodhisattva, to become someone who's helping everybody else first. And even though we don't sort of talk about these sutras so much, I think that ideal, this bodhisattva ideal, that we're kind of, we're all in this together, and that none of us really can realize awakening without all of us realizing awakening. I think that was really present for Suzuki Roshi. I didn't know him, but when I read his talks, that he really believed in trying to relieve the suffering of others. And certainly my own teacher, Koban, that was very important to him. But you've been thinking about it for 20 years.
Like I said, I don't know what he meant. But I mean, just hearing you talk about it, so like there's ways in which the different, this is sort of like the side of Buddhism you're not really supposed to talk about, right? Which is like the way each of the traditions sees the other as a little, like, not so traditionally, not now we're all very,
now we're friends.
What's the word? Now we're friends. Like you said, some of my best friends are at Spirit Rock. Is ecumenical the word?
Right.
Yeah, like ecumenical. That means like we all get along, or we all talk to each other. So, but I think in the traditions, like they did, and who knows, you know, for all kinds of reasons, probably one had to distinguish itself from the other, just the way human groups do. But I think there is a bit of a rap about the early tradition that is like self-centered. I don't, having practiced in it, I think it's probably not that accurate. But that idea that like, oh, they were about get enlightened yourself, forget about everybody else. I mean, I don't know how that really got there, because there's all this stuff about loving kindness and compassion, but I think there is utility in that ideal of the bodhisattva. So I think what sometimes people mean by that is the heart of compassion. You know, we do our practice with these simple methods with the heart of compassion, you know, for all beings. So, you know, and I think, although I do think that's very present in the, you know, in the, all the streams of Buddhism, probably maybe not everybody, there are people of different temperaments and focus on different things, but I think that's partly why I love that line, because it's like, oh, we do simple practices, the foundations of mindfulness, the practice in the early tradition, so simple, you know, mindful standing, walking, sitting, lying down, like I said, speaking, listening, breathing in, breathing out, feeling pleasant feelings, unpleasant feelings, mind states, experience, just aware. It's very simple. But with that heart, I think that's a beautiful thing, right? That quality. I think that dawns when you're practicing, that has to be, if that's not part of it, there's something going on in the method. Mm-hmm. Or that's what I think the teachers are for. But that's what I love about that sentiment. It's like, so. Because a lot of people too, and I don't want to go on too long about it, but I think a lot of people could look at when you're sitting quietly as like, oh, he seems so selfish. Mm-hmm. And misunderstand that actually when we're freer internally, mm-hmm. we're so much more available to others, right? Yeah. And I think people misunderstand that themselves. A lot of students sometimes say to me, especially newer people, say like, there's so much I'm supposed to be doing. I feel so selfish, like when I sit and meditate, like it's all about me. And I say to them, do you ever look at your phone on stuff that's not essential, like Instagram or Facebook? And they always say, yes. I say, do you feel self-centered when you're doing that? Or watching Netflix? No, they don't. Because they're not thinking about it. It's like you have a moment where you're present with yourself. It's like, oh, it's all about me. So I think that's an irony. But yeah, that's a, I'm going to go look up that line now, see what it actually says.
Probably have time for maybe one more. Yes, please.
It's very different with two of you here. So many things that go through my mind as you're speaking, like everybody, but my basic theme for the last few years seems to bubble up. So one of it, basically, I try to make it succinct, is stillness was what I wanted to mention outside of silence, which is where those forms come in. Stillness, not like this, but in a relaxed effort, which is an oxymoron. But one of the things is about existentialism, which is kind of a big word, but the way Sartre's book titled called Dirty Hands, Le Monde Sale, which means you don't really know unless you get your hands dirty. Or I like Alan Watts a lot, who talks about the meal over the menu. And people make it their careers writing menus, right? Especially wine, right? But I'm usually, if it fits exactly the menu, I'm usually kind of disappointed. Mm-hmm. And it usually doesn't. It's usually either less, and if it's more, it's like transcends the menu. I don't even think of it. So it's not really a question. I guess it's...
You're hungry for lunch.
Yeah, you know, I do think about meditation as something that you have to do, and that it's very different to do it and then, you know, to talk about it. But that sometimes that line, especially these days, feels like it gets a little blurred. I don't really want to criticize any particular style, but sometimes I'll listen to a guided meditation, let's say, online, and I'll think, well, to me, this is like listening to a podcast about meditation rather than actually meditating. And people are sometimes surprised when they come here sort of to learn meditation, and we just sit in silence, like, you know, nobody teaches them anything. And it sort of gets back to the very place where we started, that, you know, in some ways, you know, Zen doesn't have that much of a menu. It's a very, very simple. And then you just, I don't know, to just keep your metaphor going, you just eat. And you learn that way.
Metaphors are fun.
Definitely.
Yeah. There was I remember this New Yorker cartoon from a long time ago too, where there's like a couple in their apartment, like probably in New York, and there's a giant elephant in there with them, and the woman is saying to the man, it's your metaphor, Marie. You deal with it. I like that. but they're good. They're very useful, right? And we all laughed when you said what you said, because it's like, you know, the menu's not the meal. Mm-hmm. It's fine to have a menu as long as you don't eat it. Try to eat it, because it doesn't taste good. Mm-hmm. And it would be disappointing to eat the menu, for sure, I think. and one of the things, speaking, I feel like I'm here to just like cheerlead your tradition, because I love it too. Like, and I think one of the beautiful things, there's so many Dharma books. One of the things I love about Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, there's so many books about Dharma, and then there are some where you read it and it's like an expression Dharma. It's like, it's the meal, not the menu. It's like the food. And there's a few, I can only think of a few actually, that to me are like that. And that's one, where it's just, you read it and it's alive.
Can you name a few others?
Yeah, one that comes to mind is I Am That, by Nisargadatta Maharaj. It's not a, it's a collection of his dialogues, just to throw in another tradition. But every word in that seems alive to me. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, closing with your menu non-question feels appropriate because it is time for lunch.
What's on the menu?
I don't know. So again, really appreciate all of you being here. Really appreciate you, Will, you. Coming and joining us.
Thank you.
So we'll do a quick closing chant, and then you're all invited to join us up in the community building. We'll just stand in a circle up there. We'll do just a very short little announcements and things like that up there. We hope you all join us. And thank you so much, all of you who joined us online. I'm sorry you can't join us for lunch, but maybe another time soon. And yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.